Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
People will often talk about their favorite television show, their favorite movie, their favorite piece of comfort media that they watch whenever they, you know, need a little pick-me-up, or something that they watch, you know, multiple times a year, or the annual rewatch with the family. And it's amazing how important these things become to people, how much of our lives are spent consuming the stories that other people write, living in worlds that other people create. We seem to value the effect of the writer. We value what it is that they put out into the world by how it affects us. But we don't seem to value the actual creators of the work. In fact, when it comes to a discussion of paying writers fairly, a lot of people seem to have some very strong opinions about how much money writers that make our television shows and movies and stuff should be making. And that number is usually very, very, very small, which is probably one of the many, many reasons why the Writers Guild of America recently went on strike. You might have seen some headlines recently about the WGA strike, but you may not have known why they were striking or what the asks were. Well, I thought that I would ask somebody. I reached out to Joshua Conkle. He's been a guest before on the show. He's behind such shows like Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events on Netflix, as well as Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. He's a fantastic screenwriter, very talented in his own right, and he's currently on strike, so he had a little bit of time on his hands, and he agreed to come on the show and break down what the asks are in the WGA strike, explain how this is relevant to other industries, and just how AI became the center point of these negotiations. Here's Joshua Conkle. Joshua Conkle, welcome back to Head on Fire. I'm so glad to have you back. I need a writer. I need a writer to fix this, which is convenient because I have one here. How are you, sir?
It's my pleasure to be here. I can't help you. I am on strike, so I can't write anything for you without being a scab, but it's nice to see your face.
It is so nice to see your face. It's been a while since you've been here on the show. If folks don't know you or your work, maybe you haven't listened to the back catalog, tell people a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Sure. I am a Los Angeles-based screenwriter and television writer. I've written for A Series of Unfortunate Events, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and the upcoming Netflix show Dead Boy Detectives. And I'm also a huge horror fan, and I have a weekly podcast called Bloodhouse, where me and my friend Drusilla talk about art house horror films in like a funny, unpretentious way.
I love it. And I love even when you do get very pretentious about horror, because it's through folks like you, through folks like, you know, some other people that I've been very blessed to come to know, I have gained a much greater appreciation for horror. I don't know that I would still quite call it a comfort watch, but I feel like I can at least have a facility with the language of horror that I didn't have before.
Oh, thank you.
And you have, you've been instrumental in that, but I wanted to bring you on here today, specifically because, there is quite a bit of scuttlebutt in the news lately, mm-hmm. about writers, about that aforementioned strike. So we've talked before about the creative aspects of being a writer and sort of, you know, kind of the nature of what it takes to be a creative person and the kinds of voices that we listen to and stuff. And I've had those kinds of conversations with a lot of creative folks for this show and in other mediums. But I think that most people don't quite realize the business side of being a creative person. Yeah. And it's been a very gauche thing to talk about business and finances and money and all of that. But creative people have, you know, over the last several years, you know, I know authors are starting to be very forthcoming about talking about advances, mm-hmm. and advanced structure and things like that. Folks at every level starting to kind of say, you know, listen, disclosure of
not just finances, but how contracts work, how agency negotiations, how all of these things work. They only help other creatives. That, you know, the people in power will tell you, do not share this information. You know, that's bad and all of that. But it actually helps empower people to arm themselves whenever they are in those positions to negotiate.
Absolutely.
So for folks that don't have a great understanding of sort of the business aspects of being a writer, I do want to go ahead and start off by talking about the writer's strike. First of all, what is the writer's strike? What's the WGA? How did all that come about?
Yeah. So the WGA is the Writers Guild of America, and it is a 100-year-old Hollywood union, but not just Hollywood. There's a lot of media writers on the East Coast and, you know, other media hubs that are members. Basically, what happens when we strike? Let me take that back. Sorry. So every 3 years, we have to negotiate our contract, which is called the Minimum Basic Agreement, with an organization called the AMPTP, which stands for the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. And this is a group made up of representatives, lawyers, essentially, from all of the studios. So the legacy studios like Warner Brothers and Paramount, as well as the new streamers like Netflix, Amazon, Apple. And every 3 years, our representatives sit down in the Galleria in a weird, like, rented hotel room or something with these people, and they hash out a deal. It's always really, really difficult. But every once in a while, they don't reach a deal by the deadline. They have 6 weeks to reach a deal. And if they don't meet that deal, then we strike. So that is what happened on May 1st when we didn't reach our deal with them. And this is the 7th writer's strike in history. The longest was in the 80s. It was 156 days. Some millennials might remember the strike of 2007. That lasted 100 days. So we're recording this on a Sunday. So tomorrow starts week 3 of this writer's strike. And if you look at a list of all of the writer strikes in history and you see what they're about, you think like, oh, thank God they struck, because otherwise this would be a dead profession. So one was in the 50s when television became a thing. Those weren't originally guild shows, so they had to strike for that. Another one was cable television. Another one was home video. 2007 was about new media. So if we hadn't struck then, all of these Netflix and shows and stuff like that would have been not Writers Guild. And so this time, it's really all about streaming services. And most of the things that the Writers Guild are asking for pertain to TV writing, because there are more members who make their living that way. And there's just more bells and whistles because it's more than one person. So I'll talk about the feature writing side quickly because it's simpler. The one thing that they're asking for is streaming movies are priced as if they were TV movies. So if you write a movie for Netflix, you get paid at a lower price point, even if that's a $30 million movie. So what the writers...
Even if that's Red Notice with your Rock and your Gal Gadot and all of that.
Yeah. So what the Netflix is suggesting is that, like, a movie is a movie, you know? So if you're a screenwriter, what you get paid is based on the total budget of the movie. So a screenwriter for a Marvel movie gets paid more than a screenwriter of an indie film with a $5 million budget, which makes sense, right? So they're just trying to say, like, this might be a Netflix movie, but if it costs $50 million, it's a $50 million movie, whether it's going to theaters or not. The AMTP refused to talk about that. The second thing that feature writers are asking for is a guaranteed middle step. So if you're a screenwriter and you have a deal to write a movie, you have what's called a step agreement. So one step is starting the project. The other step is, you know, turning in a final draft. What happens to screenwriters is that they get their payment for the first step, and then they keep doing free rewrites because the studio says, well, you haven't done that other step yet because it's not finished. So this isn't the final draft. So they can just bilk you for a year, 2 years, however long they want to do it, till you're going to give up, or they give the project to somebody else. So the Writers Guild is asking for at least an additional step that's in the middle. That's like four rewrites.
There was a version of that, a different, I want to say a TV screenwriter that you recently retweeted, who was talking about the fact that they had a 1 month writer's room to write a 10 episode series.
Yes.
But then at the end of that, they still made the writers go do free labor to continue writing it because they didn't get the entire thing written in a single month, which obviously for 10 episodes. So, but then he had to go get a day job, because I don't think most people realize that most writers have to have day jobs.
Well, that's the thing.
Of the way the pay structure works.
Well, that brings us to television. Yeah. So here's the deal. There are technological advances that come to this industry that change the paradigm, and it takes a while for our contracts to catch up to that, right? So if you're a TV writer, your contracts are based on the old model, which is that you work for a network show, it has 22 episodes, it's filming while you're in the writer's room, so you go to set to cover your episode as a producer and then come back to the writer's room when you're done. Obviously, with streaming, that's not how things are done anymore, right? So now you have 6 or 8 or 10 episodes instead of 22. Often they'll write all of the scripts before they start production. So the writer's room is wrapped and you're done with your job before it starts shooting. So we just have to have a payment scheme that catches up with that model of making television. So with that comes like a number of asks. So you've just referenced what is called a mini room, or officially called a developmental room, but we call it a mini room here in Hollywood. And this is something that's really nefarious and has cropped up in the past 5 years. And it's like one of the number one things that the Writers Guild is trying to fight. So what these streamers have set up is like, they'll say, we're not sure if we want to green light this show or not. So what we'll do is we'll have a smaller number of writers than usual come in for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and have them create a number of storylines. And then based on that, we'll decide if we want to green light the show or not. So because it's not a real writer's room, quote unquote, all of the writers get paid the same flat fee, which is at, a smaller scale than they would normally get paid. And if I'm an executive producer and you're a first time writer, we're both earning the same amount of money because it's a flat fee. And then even if they greenlight the show, there's no guarantee that we would get hired and be in that writer's room. And we can't take any other work because we're in this room. So if it doesn't get greenlight, we've just like wasted all of that time essentially. And all of these are just like this is just a way of like finding loopholes in our contracts that they can pay us less and take advantage of us. And, you know, a lot of this too is about just making sure that writers' rooms continue to exist in the era of streaming. So a lot of what we're fighting for is just to codify things that for 100 years of Hollywood history have been social agreement. But the streamers don't know that because they're new to the business, right? So we have to now codify these things. So they're asking for minimum number of writers in a writer's room. So if you're Netflix and you order a 10 episode season of a TV show, the Writers Guild is saying, okay, well, you need to hire at least one writer per episode up to the first 6 episodes. So you have to have at least 6 writers. Then you need to keep a certain amount of them through production, whether or not production happens after the writer's room or during. That is part of the writer's job, is going to set and producing their episode, because there's always rewrites that happen on set. There's always a location that falls through. And so you have to rewrite all those scenes. You lose an actor. You have to give their dialogue to somebody else. You know, something like that always, always, always happens. Mm-hmm. And then also you need to keep a certain amount of writers through post-production as well, because even in editing, you have to write ADR, which is voiceover. You're just always writing. And so it's like codifying that a writer's job is not done until the show is complete and in the can, which was always assumed before the streamers showed up in town. And now we have to just make sure that it's codified. Again, the streamers, there's residuals. So, you know, it used to be like, if you wrote on CSI, a Brinks truck full of money came to your house every year.
You told me this a couple of years ago when we first chatted for the show. You write for a network show and it's a lottery ticket.
Yeah, basically, because, you know, you have residuals. Here's the thing with the streamers is that not only do you not get residuals, they say you get residuals, but what they do is they pay you a small fee up front. So I wrote for 4 seasons of Chilling Adventures of Sabrina on Netflix, and I made, I think, $2,500 in residuals. Right, exactly. You're making a face, and that's the face that you deserve to make. So these streamers do not share any data with anyone. It is a black box. So no one knows how many people are watching these shows and movies. And that's not really fair, because if you write for Stranger Things, which is a huge hit with millions and millions of eyes on it, you deserve to share in the great win of that product because you made it, right? Additionally,
I'm so sorry to cut off, but I feel like a good way for people to kind of absorb this is thinking about the Sandman TV show.
Yeah.
That was the biggest TV show in the entire world.
Huge.
For many, many weeks, months. Huge TV show, had a massive budget, was about as runaway of a success as I think it could be, was already a very well-established, highly successful IP. And nobody had a clue whether or not it was going to get a second season.
Yeah.
Least of all Neil Gaiman.
Right.
And there's a lot of audience members watch these Netflix shows or these streamer shows come and go that seem to be wildly successful, or at least very successful, very talked about, very beloved. You know, and they'll look on the streamer and say, oh, it's been number one. It's been in the top 10 for the last 6 months. Like, oh, this show must be doing well. Oh, why is it canceled?
Yeah.
Why is it canceled? Because, and Neil said, well, it has to do so many numbers and so many numbers, and they won't even really tell us what
they don't tell you what those numbers are.
Neil didn't quite know what those numbers were.
Right. Well, that's the other thing, right? Is it's not just writers. And by the way, this organization is now going to have to negotiate with the Directors Guild and SAG, which is the Actors Guild, who all have some version of these same concerns, right? Like, let's say you're a movie star and you agree to do a Netflix movie. Your agent has no bargaining power because they don't know how many people are going to watch the movie after it's done, how many people have watched it. And all of that, of course, affects the deal that you make as talent, or should.
And we saw a different version of that at the beginning of the pandemic when Warner Brothers said that all of their movie releases for 2020 were going to go to HBO Max.
Right.
And then suddenly, I remember, you know, a lot of people poo-pooed on her, but a lot of folks are really glad she did it. Gal Gadot went in and renegotiated for Wonder Woman. 1984.
Right.
That contract had to get renegotiated. I think several Marvel movies also had to get renegotiated, which, again, I know that some of those big tentpole things, you know, we feel very kind of gray area about.
Yeah.
But because some of these because they now create this precedent that these things can be renegotiated, that does kind of help.
It does help because
create a wave of being able to negotiate these things.
Those deals that movie stars and people like that make are based on a theatrical model where you are rewarded on the back end for a movie's success, which is fair because you're the movie star that is starring in it. So for HBO or for Warner Brothers, rather, to just suddenly say, you know what, we're going to put these on streaming instead of releasing them to the theater is completely egregious. You know what I mean? It's really, it's not right. And so it's good that they're fighting back. And there's a pretty good chance that DGA or SAG will strike too, because it is a really existential moment for all Hollywood creatives. Which brings us... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think we're both getting to the same point. So when the average person hears some of these discussions, they see very big numbers. They see very big names getting involved, and they think, this is rich people squabbling over, do I get 7 figures for something or 8 figures for something?
Well, sometimes it is. But
sure, yes. But the average writer is not that person.
No. I mean, the vast majority of people working in this industry are middle class and living in one of the most expensive cities in America. So, yeah, it's not movie stars. And it's, you know, like, people envision movie stars, or they imagine like a starving waiter who's an aspiring actor. Most people are somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And by the way, part of the reason why these businesses have traditionally been lucrative is because of unions. I don't know that some people understand that LA has always been like a very, very strong union town. And over the past 50 years, while Republicans were gutting unions across every other industry, here they remain strong. So we still have the strong unions of like the 1920s and 30s and 40s here. And so thank God, because what is happening, even with our unions, is that the streamers have turned this into a gig economy. Because the writers' rooms are so brief now, you're always scrambling for work. And even if you do make a lot of money for those 8 episodes, you've got 15 to 20 weeks of work, and you might not work again for 2 years because these jobs are really hard to get. So once you get one, you should be able to, you know, reap the benefits of having gotten these really, you know, hard to get jobs. And what will happen is, if this becomes even more of a gig economy, is that it will become a place where only like nepo babies and independently wealthy people can work. You know, we here in Hollywood have seen what has happened to journalism. We've seen what streaming did to music. So we're in real danger of having that happen to us too if we don't fight back. And the other thing I would say is, like, who gets to decide who earns what money? Like, no one thinks it's egregious that a doctor earns $300,000 a year. Like, why shouldn't a writer earn $200,000 a year or whatever? You know, it's like, who gets to decide these things? Like, why do people think that they are the arbiter of how much people get? It's sort of crazy.
One of the things I try to talk about fairly often, but I do want to make sure that we establish here, you will sometimes hear that a creative person gets a very large amount of money for some sort of writing project. I can speak from an author's perspective. You'll see, oh, this author got a 6-figure advance. They got a $150,000 advance, which is great. Lovely. Congratulations. That writer is probably keeping their day job, because what most people don't realize is the way that those advances are broken up is not you get $150,000 in a big sack of money and then they say, thank you for the book, please. It is broken up. It used to be broken up into twos. Then it was broken up into threes, into thirds. Mm-hmm. Then it was broken up into fourths. And then over the pandemic, all of these big publishers that were having their best year ever were breaking these advances up into fifths.
Yeah.
Where a writer will write the book, get an advance, get 1/5 of that money.
Yep.
And then whenever the book is turned in and accepted, which might be 6 months to a year later, gets another fifth. And then at publishing, they'll get another fifth. And then they might get more money 6 months to a year after. And yep. I think Victoria Aveyard said that her final fifth was like 2 years after pub date.
That doesn't surprise me.
And then if your book sells through the advance, by that point, if your advance is so big that it's being broken up into that amount, it probably will sell through the advance, but you don't get to actually start earning your royalties until that is completely sold through. So you might have this runaway. We saw that with Iron Widow, which is sort of an intersection with the Writers Guild right now, because that is in development as a film, as a feature. And that book was a runaway New York Times bestseller, huge all around the world. That author got $14,000 of an advance over a 2-year period.
Right. That's nothing.
Nothing. Had to live off of $14,000 for 2 years because that book was contracted for multiple sequels.
Yeah.
And then didn't even just now started earning the residuals on the royalties off of that. I know.
Right.
So that's the thing. When people hear these big numbers, I don't think they quite realize somebody isn't backing a truck up to our house either and giving us money.
Also,
that's money we have to live on, broken up for many years.
A novelist has an agent that gets like 10% of that as well. In Hollywood, it's even more than that. So I have an agent who gets 10%, a manager who gets 10%, a lawyer who gets 5%, and a business manager who gets 5%. So that's 30% of what I earn gone in one check. And that's the case for most writers. They all have some very constellation of people that are supporting them, because that's just how the business is built. And it's, do you it's have a really hard time.
Any insight whatsoever? Because publishing, film industry, especially streamers over the last like 2 or 3 years had their biggest years ever. Publishing had its biggest year in years. People were reading books. People were streaming in their homes. All of these businesses seem to have buckets and buckets of money. Any insight at all into why they seem so very invested in all of these cuts in continuing? I mean, is it just greed, or
it's greed?
Or do they have,
is there
a rationale?
It's for the shareholders. It's to make money for the shareholders. And it's all about the stock market, which is a funny thing because the streamers especially have grown so fast. And I'm not an economist, so I don't understand this completely, but they have tried their best to have their Wall Street valuations evaluate them as tech companies, but they're not. They're media companies, which grow at a completely different pace. And so they get to say that they are cash poor, but it's in like kind of Wall Street funny money, when in actual literal money, they're making billions of dollars a year. So it's like, it's kind of like true and not true at the same time, because their valuation, their stock price is like kind of in trouble, but actually they are making tons and tons of money and have never been more profitable. And by the way, this is the 90th anniversary of the Writers Guild's first negotiation with the studios when we first existed. And there was a big story about it in Variety. And it talked about how at the time, 90 years ago, MGM had a big meeting about how everyone needed to take a pay cut. And their rationale was that, like, oh, we're not sure if we're going to be profitable. We're having a really hard time right now. They said the same thing in 2007. They're like, we don't know what this new media is going to be like. It might not ever be profitable, so we can't hire Writers Guild writers. So it's always the same story from these giant billion-dollar corporations. And they're always going to say that no matter what. And the other thing I'll say about that, oh my God, I feel like I'm ranting. Like I just did.
No,
like
cocaine, that's literally why I invited you here. Please.
The other thing about that is like this era of quote unquote peak TV, they're now saying they're like, they've lost all this money from it. It's like, we, the writers and actors and directors did not compel you to make all of these shows. Like
that was
you
my next
chose
question.
To do this.
I was so curious because it even became a joke on SNL, that infamous skit where, you know, the, what's his name plays a
Hollywood executive. Show.
Oh. Yeah. And he's just throwing out money. It's a game show where a cat hosts and it asks questions about Jennifer Lopez. Money, go here. They're kind of the joke for a while was that like everything was getting greenlit. Like they would greenlight absolutely everything. Was that maybe great in retrospect? Did we need, I mean, like there would be TV shows that had like 4 or 5 seasons somehow that had been canceled 8 years ago. And then you suddenly you're like, wait, what was that? I never heard of this. What was this?
Yeah. They all did it to try to compete with each other. And the last thing, the most sort of existential thing of all is AI, which the producers refuse to talk about. And this is an interesting one because the Writers Guild put it on the agenda as an easy get, right? They're like, this is not really anything yet, but it's something we're worried about for down the road. We'll just put this on there because it's like an easy early win that will like set the table for the harder negotiations. Mm-hmm. And once they saw the reaction from the producers, then they were like, oh shit, they want this.
It's coming
really badly.
Real bad.
And the head of the producer's side, her name is Carol Lombardi or something like that. Her direct quote was like, why would we prohibit the use of something that we may want to use? So they definitely want to replace writers with AI. And
I did actually want to drill into that point specifically. So the language in the negotiation was to disallow studios from using AI to specifically edit scripts. Is that right?
I don't know. I mean, what the Writers Guild was asking for is that like all creative writing has to start with a human because the fear is that Netflix or whoever will just type into their, you know, AI thing, like GPT, like give me a show about a cat rescuing a princess on another planet or whatever, have that spit out a plot line and then hand that to one writer to like make it good. And so they're just worried that, you know, they have this dystopian vision of a future where like ChatGPT writes the show and then they give it to one writer and there's no writer's room and like everything.
Oh,
is...
sure. I mean, you know, you use an example from your own career. If Netflix came to you and said, listen, we're not going to give you a full writer's room, but if you want a fifth season of Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, here's what we're going to do. We'll take the last four seasons. We're going to shove them up a robot's butt. We'll let it spit out some scripts and we'll let you finesse them into a show.
Exactly. But, which is a lot cheaper for them, I'm sure.
Sure.
But it's like kind of a copyright thing because it's actually, you know, AI can't create anything from scratch. Mm-hmm. You would have to put all four seasons of Chilling Adventures of Sabrina into that chat, and then it might make a somewhat passable, if not boring, episode of television, but you would have to rewrite it as a human. So it can't actually create anything new. And then it affects the other unions too, because agents of actors have started to get first contract drafts from these companies that have these things that are like, and we can use your voice or likeness on any technology in perpetuity throughout the universe, which is their weird language. Like, we're going to do this on Mars or something.
Well, and we've already seen some of those apps where you can deep fake a voice. I mean, you can have Scarlett Johansson read just about anything you want now.
Yeah.
And you can deep fake an actor's face and stuff. It's there's a guy who's a very famous social media presence who does deepfake Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
And he looks and sounds exactly like Tom Cruise all over social media. And it's photorealistic. I mean, you cannot tell that it's not Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
I mean,
and I guess obviously unless you look at the body. It affects directors. I mean, there's a possibility where it could just spit out a whole movie. So all of the craftspeople, all the designers, directors, actors, writers, just gone. So that's what we're fighting against. And, you know, I'm not clueless. I know that AI is not going anywhere and the technology mm-hmm. will only get better, but we have to make sure that it is a tool for humans. You know what I mean? Like, the idea of AI was to eliminate mundane things from our lives, not the creative things that we want to do that are expressions of our soul.
Well, and I said this on social media a while back, but I want to include it in this particular conversation because you bring up a very good, very important point about AI and that it can't create anything new. The only thing that it can ever really do is create a pastiche of everything that has already been. Mm-hmm. And in most... if you're talking about publishing, if you're talking about TV, if you're talking about film, the people who have been in those writers' rooms typically come from some level of privilege. It you know, a lot of writers, it takes money and to have the time to write.
Yes, but I do want to interrupt you and say that Hollywood, no matter how people think about like nepotism and stuff, more than any other industry I've been in, actually is more of a meritocracy than most industries. I grew up in trailer parks and I came here with nothing and I made a success of myself. And that has been true. If this trend continues, it will be less true and it becomes less and less true all the time. But compared to banking or advertising or any other number of industries, it is pretty meritocratic.
But I do, what I mean is the kinds of stories that have been told have typically been a lot of the writers are typically men. A lot of the writers are typically mm-hmm. cisgender, heterosexual, white men coming from a very specific kind of perspective. So if you take everything, you know, if studios say, okay, well, we own all of these scripts. So what we're going to do is take a When Harry Met Sally and a this and a that and shove it in a robot's butt and spit out a rom-com. You're just going to keep getting the same type of perspective.
Right. You're never going to get a feedback from AI.
Correct. That's the thing. Is a different type of perspective could give you a whole new type, a whole new way of telling a story.
Right. Because it's just making collages. So it can only look backwards.
Correct.
It can't look forwards and create something.
So anytime
original.
I hear these arguments of, oh no, you know, look at, think of all the infinite things that we could do. Yes. But there's something that robot can't think of. And it's because that robot doesn't have it to build off of. Because there is somebody's perspective that hasn't been allowed in those rooms yet, or hasn't been allowed to take the reins yet. Queer folks are just now really getting to tell their stories on mm-hmm. screen. People of color are only just now. I mean, gosh, Abbott Elementary, my gosh,
yes,
that would not happen in a ChatGPT world.
But all that stuff is getting a little bit worse too, because they're, you know, 5 years ago, these streamers were like, let's just give this huge deal to some edgy lesbian comedian and give her a show. And we don't care how many people watch it, as long as it's critical darling and it's buzzy. Now there are like, they've the bubble is burst. And so mm-hmm. there are fewer TV shows all the time, even from these streamers. And now they're being, the shows that are coming down the pipeline are incredibly safe. They're just like, how do we get our own Yellowstone, basically? Which I don't, I've never watched Yellowstone, but that's the example that comes up.
My husband's obsessed. Yeah. Hallmark has a Yellowstone dupe. Hallmark.
Yeah.
Like what?
All of these streamers just want to be CBS now. They're like, how do we be CBS? And that's, you know, I mean, I feel like I've just like talked, but like HBO Max and Disney removing this content to save money and like get tax breaks and stuff like this and not have to pay residuals. The promise of streaming was always that you were going to have this vast library at your fingertips, right? Mm-hmm. But it turns out like there are fewer movies on all of the streaming services put together than used to be in your town's Blockbuster.
My God, there was a lovely day in, years ago where you could turn on Netflix and you could watch The Office and you could watch, you know, whatever you wanted. It was on Netflix. Like you had your Netflix for your movies and some TV. You had Hulu for your TV. And that's all you had. That's all you needed. Between those two, you could watch pretty much anything that had ever been made. And now I need 9 apps and nothing is on any of them.
Well, and there's this other thing that's coming down the pipeline that will have to be addressed too. Like when we talked about residuals, in streaming so far, there hasn't been residuals because you write for Orange is the New Black and Orange is the New Black is just sitting on Netflix in perpetuity. But what is starting to happen and what you'll see more of is that Netflix will sell Orange is the New Black to an ad-supported streamer like Tubi. So then Orange is the New Black will move to Tubi where maybe it can find a new audience. So mm-hmm. how will the creatives be paid for that? Those are residuals. Like, so how will the writers be, or and actors and everybody else be paid for that move to an ad-supported streamer like Tubi? Because now essentially there will be residuals, or should be, in streaming, because actually your show is going into syndication.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's going to a cheaper ad-supported streamer. And talking about that, Netflix is about to have an ad-supported tier as well, which makes it the last holdout. I think every streamer has an ad-supported tier now. I know from having worked in advertising for 10 years before I did this, advertisers need that data. If they're going to pay you to place an ad, they need to know how many eyes are on that program. They need to know all this. So it'd be interesting to see if the streamers put that behind like non-disclosure agreements or what, because at some point they've got to release that data. They just have to.
Yeah. That I know that a lot of people for a long time have been wanting that data, even just down to like, I know to be considered for certain kinds of awards, you know, there's just all mm-hmm. sorts of data that these awards companies want to know, like, do you even qualify? What even are you? Did anybody watch? Is this real? Is this a real movie?
The reason we had the Nielsen ratings in the old, you know, network television days was for advertisers, so that you knew exactly how many people were watching your show live, how many people were watching it in reruns, how many people were watching it in syndication. So you knew how much was worth spending on your soap commercial or whatever. So that's going to have to come back. At least the advertisers will need to know, if no one else. Whether they block that behind NDAs or whatever, I don't know. But like, the information's got to get out there in some way.
And I know for anybody who doesn't value the creative arts as work, some of this I'm sure sounds like, you know, I don't know, I'm sure greed, you know, I'm sure somebody somewhere is saying, oh, you all just want more money. Well, yeah, sure. Yes. Yeah. I mean, if you work a corporate job and you come up with a way to improve a process at your corporate job, and you start implementing that process just kind of at your own desk. And this has happened to me at my own corporate job. You just kind of implement that process at your desk and it makes your life a lot easier. And your manager notices and it's like, hey, what's going on here? And then your manager tells some higher up and then they come say, hey, what's going on here? I promise I'm going somewhere with this. What's going on here? I like this. What are you doing? Could you train other people?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I can show other people how I'm doing this. Yeah, that's fine. And then so you train 10 people.
Mm-hmm. And then actually, I really like, I think we're going to actually codify, we're going to make this now part of the training. And then we want you to train other people. And that, so suddenly you're doing all of this extra work on top of your work to train other people on a process that now you've basically kind of given to your company so that it can make, help them make more money faster for themselves.
Yeah.
But you are not making more money. You're just mm-hmm. doing more work, and other people are making more money off of something that you created.
Yeah.
This happens a lot in a lot of corporate settings.
Yeah.
Where somebody comes up with something, some way of making the job easier, that someone with enough influence and power who could very much benefit from that financially takes from you, bolsters you up, gives you a $5 Starbucks gift card, pats you on the back, says, thank you. We'll definitely think about this when it comes time for promotions. No, they won't. And then you don't ever actually see any benefit, but suddenly suddenly you're training your own replacement. Suddenly you're training your boss. Suddenly you're doing all this extra labor and not being paid for it. This kind of discussion happens in all sorts of industries. We just yes. don't call it the same thing.
Yeah.
We just don't think of it in the same way. But if you are creating work that other people are able to profit from, and they are able to just take the thing that you made and create different iterations of it, create different versions of it, sell it off to other people, license it to other people, find 100 million different ways to make money off of your thing that you created. Why can't you get a piece of that? Why is it wrong to ask for a piece of that?
It's a few things, I think. First of all, America hates California and hates Hollywood. Despite yes. everybody watching films and television, there's so much resentment towards this state and this industry. The other thing is writing. Like, I don't know why. Even actors and directors don't get this as bad as we do. Everyone thinks that they can write.
Yeah, everybody thinks they can
write. If you look
at
the WGA hashtag, you know, the strike hashtags on Twitter, it's everyone's like, oh, well, you know, 99% of people could do this job better than this. So, like, let's just
then
replace
do it.
Them. And it's like, then do then it.
Go. Do it.
Do it.
Go do it.
You
Have
know,
fun. It's hard.
It's really hard. And it is a meritocracy. The people who are doing the stuff, of course, there are Nepo people that get in and all that sort of stuff. But really, it is the cream of the crop who are able to make their living doing this. If you think you could do better, please try. We always need people. We always need new people. So maybe you can. But it's just so insulting. I feel like it's everyone can read, so everyone thinks that they can write. You know, like, it's so weird. But when you're talking about processes, you know, that's why it's so important for writers to go to set, because that's how you learned to do the job. You know, that's the way that you learn to become a showrunner and one day have your own show. And so while they think they're saving money now, it's going to screw them later when they have showrunners who don't know how television is made.
Didn't
and
George R.R. Martin. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But if the writers of 2023 aren't allowed to go to set, where will you get your showrunners and for the shows in 2033?
Exactly. I mean, it's crazy. It really is a craft as much as it is an art, right? Because you're not writing a novel, which is a different thing. You're writing a TV show. So you have to know, like, okay, how many sets can I have? When do I have this? So you're writing towards a set of logistics in a way that isn't true of other writing mediums necessarily. And so if you don't go to set, you'll never learn how to do that. And it's just so important. And it's going to cost studios a lot more later on if they don't understand this. And by the way, the legacy studios, Warner Brothers, Paramount, the people that have been running Hollywood successfully 100 years, know all of this. And it's frustrating to watch them not stand up to Netflix and Apple and Amazon, because these like great disruptors of tech, as they like to call themselves, they really are disruptors. They really did disrupt this industry and really fuck it up. And so we just, you know, none of us are delusional. We know we're not going back to 22 episode network television shows. We understand the creative side of this. We just need a contract that matches where we are now instead of a contract for the landscape of 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
I've heard some of the, you know, if you cut like the salaries for two people, that would pay for everything that all of the writers are asking for. So because I didn't ask up front, what are the specific asks? How does this translate to dollars and cents? I feel like that would help people understand that this really isn't the big asking for the moon that I think some people might think it is.
Well, I mean, I don't have like exact facts and figures in front of me, but a lot of it is about duration, right? So it's like you need to have one writer per every episode, up to 6 episodes. You need to guarantee that the writers will have 3 weeks of work per episode. You need to make sure that you have at least this number of writers through, you know, your room can get smaller after the writing is done, but then you need to keep one or two for production. You need to keep at least one for post-production. So it's about just like codifying the importance of the writer's room and making sure that it continues to exist. And then there are also, no, you know, like minor things that they've already agreed to, which like you're raising this minimum, you know, we'll ask for 6% increase on whatever, and they'll give us 4.5 or whatever. So like those things are easy and have already been agreed to. There were just these issues that they refused to negotiate on. And so we had to strike.
If they don't agree on the AI point, Do you think you can have a deal if they don't agree on the AI point?
No.
I think it's weird how much they're holding on to it. And I feel like that tells you you really need to make sure that they don't cut that out.
Yeah, it's existential. It really is do or die. And not just for us, but for the directors and the actors and everyone else in this industry as well. Because I feel like if we don't do it now, in 10 years, it'll be too late. And by the way, do you know what the producers offered in exchange for the AI thing? Their offer was, we're willing to have a meeting about it every year to check
in. I saw that. I was like, oh, God.
So nothing.
It's terrible. That's bad. It's like, well, we're not gonna agree or disagree now. How about this? We'll talk about it next year. We'll go have lunch.
They offered the same thing for quote unquote new media in 2007, which is streaming. And they were saying like, let's just see how this plays out. So we know from experience how it will play out if we don't strike over it.
The way that this is being written about in the media, I'm telling you, some studio somewhere must have paid a journalist.
Yeah.
Air quotes here. Somebody must have paid somebody to be like, well, it's all the writer's fault, really. The way that they're doing this is like, oh, the season finale of SNL in here because of the writer's strike. And oh, your favorite shows were on hold because of the writer's strike. And it's like, no, your favorite shows are on hold because studios have decided that they want to shove all the creative work up a robot's butt and starve actual humans. Like this is a whole different narrative here, bud.
They're trying to turn us into a gig job, like Uber drivers and that sort of thing. And if that happens, it'll just be an industry where only independently wealthy people can afford to do this. And it'll be like a hobby job. So, you know, it'll be like the kind of thing that 22-year-olds do for 2 years before they get tired and then go to law school, which is like how theater, you know, I was a playwright before I was a TV writer. That's how theater is. It's like only rich people get to be playwrights and they're only making art for rich people. And I don't want that to happen to TV writing.
Do you have any, you know, words of hope or wisdom for perspective screenwriter, somebody who wants to get into the industry? from a business perspective. I mean, we've talked about the creative stuff, but like, you know, there's a lot about, I mean, when I signed my first deal, I had lots of phone calls with like everybody I knew that had ever been a writer. Cause I was like, wait, this is a big deal. Cause I didn't have an agent at the time.
Yeah.
Which is probably why I got so screwed on my first advance. But I was like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm signing. I don't know how to do any of this. I don't know, you know, does any of this work? Am I getting screwed here?
Well, to talk about an earlier point about how it seems like a lot of money, I will say when you get your first deal, when you get a movie deal or you're staffed on a TV show, it's going to seem like a lot of money, but it isn't, because the chances are that it will take you a year or more to get your second job. So don't go buy a car. Don't go. I mean, you can't afford to buy a house anymore like you could in the 90s or anything. But like it's going to seem like a lot of money, and it really isn't, because so much of it is going to your agent and manager, and you just don't know when you're going to work again. So that's a mistake I've made twice, and it was really painful both times. And that's the thing I would say. Otherwise, I would say like creatively and business-wise, find your people, connect to young filmmakers that are your age or actors that you love that are on your age that are like doing theater. Like, find your tribe, because some of those people are going to skyrocket and they can help you, or vice versa. Like, every job I've ever had is from people that are old friends that I've known since I was doing theater. You know, I've been in some version of this industry for 20 years. And so now some of the people that were next to me when I was 21 are movie stars or giant showrunners. And that's just from sticking it out and being around long enough to see that happen.
Yeah, that's the same advice for any creative field. You just be good to people. Yeah. Surround yourself with good people. Don't be jealous of other people's success, because success in your circle breeds success in your circle. If somebody else is having a good year,
a win for everybody. And unlike some industries, like when I was a playwright, I got sick with jealousy because the stakes are so high. Like, if one person got a grant, literally they got it and no one else did. So their success really was my loss. In this industry, there's enough for everybody. So
everybody
be really happy for people.
If you get a rejection from this publisher, if you get a rejection from this studio, there's so many other publishers, there's so many other studios. You can get your work out there.
Yeah. And what I will say, like, I'm so horny for unions because of all of this. I am radicalized. Everyone should be in a union. It is the most beautiful thing. Like, this is really uncomfortable times. People are going to lose their houses. All of these horrible things are going to happen to creative people. But being out there on the picket line and having people honk at you and to know that you're on the right side, it is so gratifying and makes me feel so hopeful.
I have heard some things about this picket line, mostly from this week's episode of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR.
Ooh, I want to listen to that.
Where apparently we're putting pink tape and blue tape on our picket signs to tell other screenwriters who we're interested in, and we're using the picket line as dating.
Ooh, I haven't noticed that. Well, there is like so they are starting to organize events within the picket line. So my friend Michael Kennedy,
I love it,
organized like a queer takeover of the Netflix picket line last week. So on Thursday from like 9 to 1 p.m., it was all gays. It was like being at the Eagle while you picketed. And I know that some people have organized like singles events within the picketing. So it's like, maybe that's what you're talking about. Thursday of this upcoming week, there's like a trans takeover of the Netflix picket line. And then all the different picket lines have a different vibe. Like, everyone's super mad at Netflix, so that one's super packed all the time and like really like has a party vibe. The Paramount one feels like kind of horny. It's just like all of the different studios have like a different vibe. It's really wild. And it's like a social scene, because you see people you haven't seen in 2 years. You know, you see old friends from, I see old friends from New York that used to be playwrights with me that I haven't seen in 10 years or longer. And so it's kind of fun in a way. You're like seeing old friends and you're getting some exercise and it's cool.
How did the nanny get wrapped up in all of this? I just saw a headline the other day about Fran Drescher had some real bad takes. Well,
Fran Drescher is the president of SAG, which is the Actors Guild.
I did not know this.
Yeah.
I just thought she was off doing Hallmark movies, counting her money these days.
They need to strike with us. I don't know if they will, because their union is so huge. We have 11,000. They have like 200,000 people in their union. And most of the membership of SAG, of course, they're actors. So, of course, most of them aren't working and they're really hungry and it's hard times for actors most of the time. So I think a lot of them are probably too afraid to strike. But
some of those tiny parts could be given to an AI if they're not, don't get watched, you know, somebody that just has some waitress in a diner with one line handing you coffee. Like, you could make that a robot if the studio really wanted to. You could make a movie with three people now. Like, come on. Yeah. We all need to be in this. Is there anything giving you hope about, do you feel like you're going to be reaching an agreement? Do you feel good about the direction that things are going?
I feel good right now. Last week, the DGA, the Directors Guild, started negotiating with the AMPTP, but there's a media blackout, so no one knows the tenor of those negotiations. And My only fear is that, so usually the DGA goes before the WGA, but because they're pissed at the studios too, they decided to go after us because everyone knows in town that the WGA is the most hardcore union and the most willing to strike. So that we're the scariest for the producers. So they decided to go after us because our win is their win, essentially. But because they have a different agenda, sometimes they can kneecap us by making a deal. So that would effectively end our strike if they made a deal really quickly. So everyone's kind of watching the DGA right now. That's what happened in 2007. After 100 days, they reached a deal with the producers and effectively ended the writer's strike. But yeah, we'll see.
Do you still love this job? Is it still something you...
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm thinking about like getting an MFA because I never got one. So I'm writing a kid's book right now because I've never written a book. And I'm like, maybe I'll write.
Welcome. Hey.
Thank you.
We'll have
you. It seems worse in a lot of ways.
It's hell. It is hell.
Here's my dream, though, because I ended up writing for television by accident. This is not what I wanted to do, although I do like doing it. But my new dream is to do a low-res MFA, write children's books under a pen name, move to a college town and teach writing and just live in a beautiful small town and have a cottage in the wood.
Children's books. You are going to be elbowing your way past celebrities with their vanity projects. Oh boy, that children's lit world is.
I mean, I worked for Lemony Snicket, right? So I know him very well.
So that age group. So I'm like, we're not talking like kids books, like tiny kids books.
I'm talking about middle grade novels.
Okay, gotcha.
But
okay.
I saw his life and I was like, I want that.
Oh,
but
for
only
sure.
He gets. I mean, the only two people get that. It's like him and She Who Must Not Be Named, and whoever wrote Percy Jackson, I guess.
I
but like,
yeah,
they're the only ones.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your time. Good luck out there on the picket lines. Are you?
Thank you guys.
It feels like every time I turn social media on, like it's a TV. It feels like, you know, you guys are getting, at least maybe not from the guild itself, but there's a lot of actors that seem to be very supportive. There's a lot of big names seem to be very, very supportive of this particular strike. And I think a lot of people realize, most especially because of the weird way that AI suddenly became the center, you know, center point of this negotiation, the way that that is now affecting just about every job out there and the way that this strike goes could affect jobs that aren't even related to Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of support from the directors and the actors so far, and God bless the Teamsters, man, the truck drivers, because they don't have to cross picket lines. And so if they see even just two writers outside of a production, they turn off their truck, take their keys and leave. So we've been shutting down productions everywhere because of the Teamsters, who are just like so incredible. So we have a lot of support so far from the other unions, and that's been great.
Can I ask, before I let you go, about some strike terminology?
Sure. I don't know if I'll have an answer.
Some of this, I don't know. What's a scab?
A scab is anybody who crosses a picket line to do work.
Oh, that doesn't sound good. That sounds like it would be...
Kentucky, right? My family is all coal miners.
Yeah.
So my family's very involved in like union politics going back 100 years. And so one of the first lessons I learned as a kid, even before I knew what it meant was never cross a picket line. So a scab is anybody who crosses a picket line to do work.
Sounds like that would undercut the entire point of negotiations like, hey, well, we're not really striking. We'll still come to work.
Yeah. It's like basically like being a rat. And by the way, if you scab as a writer, there are like witch hunt type mechanisms for people to report you. And you will never be allowed to join the WGA. You're blacklisted for life. So
that's
don't
why
do it.
So many
Not
people
worth
have
it.
Been like, so they're saying that studios are reaching out to like novelists and young writers and stuff like that, saying, hey, would you want like a big truck full of what you think is a big truck full of money to come just write just this little thing for us, please, if you could. And there's been so many people that are like, do not take that deal.
Don't do it. You're a scab. And like, they know, believe me. So let's say you have a book that they want to turn in, like they want you to write the script of it. The WGA will know. And not only will you be blacklisted from ever joining the WGA, but they'll in terms of adapting your work and stuff too, they'll be like, nope, this person was a scab in 2023. They are blacklisted from Hollywood. So it's really not worth it.
it's really not worth it. Be a good person. And then maybe you can work again in the future. And when you do work, you'll have a better deal. You will have a better quality of life.
Because of unions. I mean, because all of this unions. Is because of unions. You know,
bless writers, novelists, authors. Authors need a union. Authors
they should have one. Everyone should have a union.
Everybody should have a union.
I'm a believer.
I didn't realize until years after the fact when me and some other authors became friends, like how crappy my first deal was.
Yeah.
Well, Joshua Conkle, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for walking us through the current issues surrounding the writer's strike. If folks would like to see what you were doing while you were striking, where can they find you online?
You can follow me at Twitter or Instagram at Joshua Conkle, or you can follow me on Letterboxd if you want to see my film reviews at Joshua Conkle. And you can listen to Bloodhouse every Monday. It's Blood, H-A-U-S, like Bauhaus.
Thank you so much for being here, sir. Good luck on the picket
line. Thank you, John. Thank you.
And that is going to do it for this episode of Head on Fire. All the gratitude in the world to my guest, Joshua Conkle, who you can find in a picket line near you. Remember, if you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider sharing it with your friends on social media. You could also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, consider leaving a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners like you. It's been a while since the show's gotten some reviews. We've got a lot more listeners these days. I'm just saying, it's kind of sketchy that you guys are not reviewing the show that you clearly listen to. So I'm just not to throw any shade at all, but just like, I'm just saying, like, it would be super cool of you. Just be like super cool if you would just like on the phone that you're already listening to this on, just like go, just hit the button, just hit the review button and hit those 5 stars, you know, just leave a couple of emojis, like literally just a couple of emojis. That'll help. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners like you. If you hate the ads at the beginning and end of each episode, consider joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and fun little extras along the way. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. You can connect with me on social media. I am at headonfirepod everywhere. I am going to go, but before I do, please, please remember, don't cross a picket line, you scab. Be well.